He never said we were exclusive. I want to be clear about that. Looking back, I can see exactly how carefully that was arranged, how every conversation that might have required a direct answer was redirected, dissolved into laughter or ended with him touching my face in a way that made me feel foolish for having asked. But he never lied. He was meticulous about that. The lies were mine. I told them to myself. And he watched and he said nothing that might interrupt. We met in October. By November, I had already rearranged things around him. Dinner reservations moved, friendships deprioritized, weekends cleared, that had previously held commitments I'd been looking forward to for months. None of this was demanded. He never asked me to be available. He simply was available, intensely and consistently, in a way that made being unavailable feel like a failure of some unstated agreement between us. When I was available, he called it his favorite thing. When I was unavailable, he was gracious but slightly quieter in the days that followed. And I learned to manage my schedule to prevent those quieter days. By January, I had introduced him to nobody. This is the fact I come back to most often now, sitting with it in the way you sit with evidence you should have examined earlier. I had told everyone about him. My sister, my closest friend, the women I work with who make a project of my romantic life, but none of them had met him. He was always almost ready for that. He wanted it to be the right moment. He'd had a complicated history with a girlfriend who'd pushed things too quickly, and he'd learned, in that relationship, to value patience. I understood. I was patient. I told myself that the waiting was intimacy of a particular kind, that we were building something that deserved a careful foundation. The reservation was the thing I found in February, and I'm not sure I've fully processed what it did to me to find it. I wasn't looking for anything. He'd asked me to add something to his calendar while he drove. We were in his car, he was navigating, his phone was in my hand, and I was in his favorites when I saw it. A restaurant reservation. Bully Botanical. February 14th. Table for two. 7:30 p.m. In a name I recognized as his. The reservation was from 3 years earlier. It was in his favorites, I realized, because he'd favorited the restaurant when he made the reservation, and the app had saved it in perpetuity. February 14th. Table for two. In his name. He has taken someone to dinner on Valentine's Day 3 years ago. This should have been unremarkable. 3 years ago, we had not met. 3 years ago, he owed me nothing. 3 years ago, he was a stranger who was living his life and going on dates and making dinner reservations for the kind of evening that people make reservations for. I looked at the date of the reservation. I looked at the name on it. I looked at the table for two notation that was so ordinary and so complete, and I felt in my chest something that I can only describe as a window showing me a version of his life in which I did not exist, in which there was a woman, a different woman, being taken to Bully Botanical by the same man who was driving, right now, with his left hand on the wheel, telling me to close the app and add it to Thursday. I closed the app. I added it to Thursday. I said nothing. The exit mirage arrived in March. He talked, for the first time, about Paris. Not specifically about going to Paris with me. He was careful, always careful, but about Paris as a concept, as a place he wanted to spend more than 2 weeks in at some point in his life, as a city that rewards the right kind of company. He used the phrase, the right kind of company, and looked at me when he said it. And I understood that I was being gestured toward without being directly invited, and I felt the warm pull of that implication as if it were a fact. I started looking at apartments in the 6th arrondissement. I didn't tell anyone. I bookmarked 3 separate sites on my laptop and looked at them on quiet evenings after he'd called and before I fell asleep. I was 34 years old. I had a career that I was good at, and a life that was by any measurement that people who cared about me would apply, working. I had chosen to reorganize it around a man who had never once said the word exclusive, who had never met my sister, who had 3-year-old Valentine's Day dinner reservations saved in his favorites, and who was now gesturing in the direction of Paris, the anchor I returned to. The detail that sits with me now in a way it never sat with me then, is the napkin in my car. I'd given him a lift home once in January, and he'd left a cloth napkin on my passenger seat. He'd brought food from somewhere, I can't remember the specifics, and it sat on that seat for 3 weeks before I moved it to the glove compartment, and then it sat there for 2 more months. I knew it was his. I knew it was a cloth napkin and not a paper one. The kind you own rather than take, and that he'd left it without asking me to return it. I moved it to the glove compartment rather than returning it because I liked having it there. It felt like evidence of occupancy. It felt like proof when things ended. And things ended slowly, in the way that things that were never fully started can end slowly, through a gradual withdrawal of the intensity that had characterized the beginning, through calls that came less frequently and felt less present when they came, through the quiet that stretched between messages without any acknowledgement that anything had changed. I was sitting in my car one afternoon and found the napkin in my glove compartment and held it for longer than was useful. He had never said we were exclusive. He had never promised Paris. He had never asked me to rearrange my weekends or deprioritize my friendships or not introduce him to my sister. He had done something more durable and more invisible than any of that. He had simply maintained a particular quality of presence. Intense, consistent, almost promising, and allowed me to build everything else around it. The thing I understand now, that I did not understand then, is that what was being managed was my hope, not my feelings. My feelings were mine. They came from me, but the specific calibration of my hope, too little hope, and I'd have stopped making room for him. Too much hope, and I'd have pressed for things he wasn't willing to give. What he managed, with an accuracy I still find remarkable in retrospect, was the exact level of hope required to keep me in place without any formal commitment on his part. The choice point, the moment I think about most often, was February, in his car, with the reservation on his screen. That was the moment I could have said, "I found this, and I want to know what it means to you." I could have asked a direct question and required a direct answer. I didn't. I closed the app and added it to Thursday. I closed the app and added it to Thursday because I had already decided, at some level below conscious choice, that an answer was more frightening than the uncertainty I was managing. An answer would have required me to act on whatever it contained. The uncertainty allowed me to stay. This is the part they don't put in the advice. It's not that you don't see the signs. It's that you see the signs and decide, very quietly, that not seeing them is less costly. The cost of staying was patience and hope, and a cloth napkin in a glove compartment. The cost of leaving was the loss of Paris, the loss of the man who called my being available his favorite thing, the loss of the version of the future I had constructed so carefully in the months between October and February. I stayed. And I constructed. And eventually the construction collapsed under its own weight because it had no foundation in anything he'd actually agreed to build. Understanding this changed how I see everything around me, not just romantic things. The places in my professional life where I'd stayed past the point of honest assessment, the friendships I'd maintained through the calibrated hope that they would become something more reciprocal, the ambitions I'd kept at the level of almost reaching because actually reaching would have required a clarity I was managing around. The full breakdown is in the episode. Follow now, because understanding this changes how you see everything around you. In the weeks before February, the weeks when everything still felt like it was building toward something, he was most consistent about one specific thing. And I see it clearly now as a structural mechanism that had nothing to do with love. He was consistent about validation of my uncertainty. Every time I felt the edge of something, the sense that I didn't quite know what we were, that I didn't know where to place this in my life, he would say something that landed softly and removed the edge. Not promises, not lies, just a quality of attention that made the uncertainty feel like a choice I was making freely rather than a condition I was being held in. "You're not a person who needs definitions," he told me once. We were walking in November, early in the relationship, and I'd made some reference, careful, oblique, not quite asking to what we were doing. That's what he said. "You're not a person who needs definitions," and I took it as a compliment, as insight into my character, as evidence that he understood something true about me. He said it in a tone that meant, that quality makes you remarkable. And the remarkable quality he was naming was, in plain English, my willingness not to ask direct questions. I think about that sentence often. It did three things simultaneously. It told me something flattering about myself. It framed asking for clarity as a weakness I was admirably free from. And it closed the conversation without closing anything at all. It was a perfect piece of misdirection. And I walked through the November afternoon feeling seen. My closest friend asked me, sometime in January, what we were. I gave her the answer I had perfected by then. We were figuring it out. We were in the early stages. He'd had a complicated previous relationship and needed to take things at his own pace. But the connection was real and I was giving it space. She listened. She said, with the careful flatness of someone choosing her words, you sound like you're building a case. I laughed. I changed the subject. She was right. I had been building a case. Accumulating evidence. Arranging it into an argument for something I wanted to believe. Sorting the ambiguous signals into the category of promising rather than the category of insufficient. The napkin in the glove compartment. The Paris conversation. The way he said favorite thing. These were not facts. They were materials I had recruited into a narrative, and the narrative was doing work that the actual relationship was not. The word that I didn't have for what I was experiencing while I was experiencing it was future faking. I'd never encountered it. It sounds clinical when you see it written down. The deliberate use of implied future commitment to sustain a relationship in the present without the commitment ever materializing. But the experience of it isn't clinical. The experience of it is warm and specific and feels like being seen. The experience of it is the way he looked at me when he said the right kind of company. The experience of it is the Paris conversation happening exactly when the November intensity was starting to fade and I needed something to hold. I think about the other woman at Bouley Botanical on Valentine's Day 3 years ago, whoever she was, the woman who that reservation was for. And I wonder if she had a cloth napkin she kept somewhere. I closed the app and added it to Thursday.